The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The ancient Egyptians postulated 7 souls. Top soul, and the first to leave at the moment of death, is Ren, the secret name. This corresponds to my director. He directs the film of your life from conception to death. The secret name is the title of your film. When you die, that's where Ren came in. Second soul and second one off the sinking ship is second. Energy, power, light. The director gives the orders. Second presses the right button. Number 3 is Ku, the guardian angel. He, she, or it is third man out. Number 4 is Ba, the heart, often treacherous. Number 5 is Ka, the double. The Ka, which usually reaches adolescence at the time of bodily death, is the only reliable guide through the land of the dead. Number 6 is Kahabit, the shadow, memory, your whole past conditioning from this and other lives. Number 7 is Seku, remains.
Halfway to China.
Welcome, everybody, to Aeon Byte. So good to see you on this Monday, and I hope everybody had a good weekend, and I hope you're ready to have a good week. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am honored to be your host on these great topics that go down into so many caves for treasures. And today is no different. Today we shall be going down into many underworlds, literally and metaphorically, but hopefully educationally. And I know you're going to come back with some treasure on this one. So without further ado, it is an honor to be joined today by Dr. Gregory Shushan, to discuss a book I enjoyed a lot. And it's, so much great information, and that is Near Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, The Origins of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. Gregory, thank you very much for coming on the show, and how are you doing?
I'm good, Miguel. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure is all ours. And with us, it's good to have as our wingman and perhaps our psychopomp is Graham Pong. Graham, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing very good, Miguel. I'm looking forward to hearing what the ancients had to say about near-death experiences, since I know they had much more experience with death than we do.
They had a lot to say. Boy, were they had a lot to say. I'm glad we're catching up. So awesome. Everybody seeing you already going into the chat. As always, if you have any questions or comment, please super chat them so we can get to them. And we will answer your questions or your issues or whatever you have on your mind. Other than that, not much housekeeping today, so we should definitely get started. Before we talk about your book, Gregory, please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in this topic.
Sure. Yeah, I actually started out in Egyptian archaeology, and I knew about near-death experiences like everybody does, but I wasn't really pursuing it professionally, and I wasn't thinking about it in terms of the ancient world until I was reading the ancient Egyptian books of the afterlife, especially the pyramid texts and the coffin texts, which precede the Book of the Dead, which is the one everybody knows about. But the Book of the Dead is like two-thirds of that is derives from the earlier texts. So as I was reading these while I was studying Egyptian archaeology, this was at University College London at the Institute of Archaeology, I just started noticing that if you strip back some of the cultural expressions of some of these ideas, that beneath them seems to lie like a substrate of near-death experience descriptions. So just for example, the texts describe how the soul leaves the body, which is comparable to an out-of-body experience, or is an out-of-body experience, enters darkness, comes out into a realm of light, meets a being of light, in this case it's the sun god Re, has actually an observation from out of the body of their own corpse, and that's like in the form of the god Osiris, because the soul of the deceased is associated with Osiris, and so therefore it's like this corpse encounter, and then meeting deceased relatives, some kind of evaluation of their earthly life, comparable to a life review. So all these kind of elements. And I just started thinking that actually sounds a lot like a near-death experience. And I wondered if it's possible that these ancient beliefs were grounded in near-death experience. So that's the kind of the long answer of how I got into it.
Yeah, fascinating. Your book covers so much ground and so much data. Just for the audience, it's worth its price in gold, just your very detailed description of what people, the ancient Egyptian afterlife voyage. I felt we were going to see Frodo and Sam because it's like this great epic just to get there, right?
I deliberately wanted to include lots of detail and present the text the way they actually are, rather than like cherry picking the similarities to NDEs, because over and over, I run across books about NDEs where people say, NDEs are the same everywhere, and they're just not. It's just not the case. So I didn't want it to seem like I was overgeneralizing about afterlife beliefs either. I didn't want it to, like these earlier scholars of comparative religions like Maciej Eliade or the kind of Victorian comparative religion scholars, and even people like Joseph Campbell, Carl Jung, for example. There's a lot of overgeneralizing where they just kind of say, the afterlife journey is universal. So I wanted to make really clear that we're dealing with very much culturally embedded texts. And I don't want to just strip away all that to present this false narrative of similarity. So because the differences are just as important and kind of require explanation just as much as the similarities do.
Yeah, indeed. And why did you decide to pick these civilizations? And I have them here written down. Obviously, we just talked about ancient Egypt. You picked early dynastic Sumer and old Babylonian Mesopotamia, Vedic India, pre-Buddhist China, Maya, and Nahua Aztec Mesoamerica. So those you would consider ancient civilizations that enough data? Is that, or what was the reasoning behind them?
There's a few reasons, actually. Technically, the term is early civilizations. So regardless of the time frame, the fact that by the time the ancient Egyptian civilization was collapsing, the Mayans were still going up to 1500 years, but they started much, much later. So this kind of relative chronology where there was no contact between them. So the idea that they all emerged more or less independently, culturally independently from the others, because again, I didn't want there to be any kind of claim where people would say, well, they're all similar because the Egyptians thought of it and then it passed on to the Sumerians and then made its way to China. That's just not happening. That's called diffusion in these kind of comparative studies. So I wanted to minimize the possibility of diffusion, basically.
Could you expand on diffusion and why you find it problematic? You go on in detail in your book.
Yeah. And it kind of goes back to 19th century. It's the thing that a lot of people just jump on. And classical studies, I'm doing a project now on Greek and Roman near-death experiences. And the kind of default explanation is, oh, they're similar because they had contact with another culture and they were borrowing from them. Right. And that's the diffusion of the idea or the myth from one culture to another. And the argument is usually made based on just the fact of similarity alone. It's not based on like whether anything else was shared, the degree of contact between them, or in fact, any evidence that, you know, other than the similarity that the myth was actually shared. And so to me, to minimize that and think, well, there actually is this human experience type, a universal human experience type, which is completely irrelevant. And why isn't anybody looking at that as a possibility for generating these beliefs?
Yeah, you could have just written one page in your book, the aliens did it and walked away, right? That would have been
easier. Yeah, and it ties into that kind of discussion because, people will say, how could the Egyptians have built the pyramids? It must be aliens. And then how could the Mayans and Aztecs built the pyramids? It must have been Egyptians. Right. So it's always this narrative of like the people there couldn't have done or couldn't have come up with what they actually came up with. And I don't buy any of those arguments at all.
Yeah. Although it must be said, alien abductions do parallel near-death experiences. But obviously that's a whole nother genre in comparative scholarship. But right. Anyway, somebody's going to bring it up, especially in the circles we run with. And before we get into the cultures and sort of break them down, I guess for the audience, probably just so we can cover this and refresh, what is a near-death experience? I think you write, near-death experiences typically occur during the periods of clinical death or near-death, after which an individual, upon resuscitation, reports having had a mystical or spiritual episodes. Is that good enough, Gregory?
Yeah, I think that's good enough in a kind of broad general definition. I guess the only thing to add really is that, you know, the experience itself is made up of these particular individual episodes. So leaving the body, entering darkness, the being of light, deceased relatives, and all that. But it has to be said, even, this is now like the 50th anniversary of near-death studies, formal near-death studies in the West. 50 years ago that Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, was published. Nice. He invented the term near-death experience. Obviously, these experiences were happening long before Moody, probably since humans have been around. It's just a matter of... He tried to kind of codify the experience, and he came up with like 15 different sub-experiences that would make up a typical NDE. But even at that time, he stressed like he didn't know any example that had all of those features. So already there was this kind of indication of like not all NDEs are the same. There's a lot of diversity. But nevertheless, the kind of stereotype idea of what an NDE is what everybody... it's in everybody's mind, you know, so the tunnel, the life review and all that. Right. So. And then throughout near-death studies, after Moody, people like Bruce Grayson and Kenneth Ring went to kind of great efforts to further codify the NDE and say, okay, here's a list of 17 or 21 or whatever elements. And if the person has five or six out of these, then that's a near-death experience. I kind of took the opposite approach. I decided that if somebody... has a contextual death experience, meaning that, you know, the experience happens in the context of they die, apparently, and then revive and tell about their experiences in the meantime. That's an NDE, regardless of what they're actually reporting. To me, that kind of honors what the experiencer is saying and what's happening within the culture, rather than kind of imposing our judgment or determination on these experiences. If they consider it a trip to the afterlife realm, then I accept it. And what was interesting about that is it's not like I came up with lots and lots of completely unusual, crazy things. Like there's no culture where going to Mars is the typical thing in an NDE. So they still ended up being within the kind of Grayson model of you know, these typical sub experiences, but expressed in culturally different ways.
No, that makes sense. And I believe you quote, I forget who you quote, but you say that what cultures, what 10% of people have near-death experiences. Is that right?
That's what they say. Yeah. In the West. But that's, you know, that's another issue, especially since I'm a historian of religions. I'm dealing with historical texts. We don't really know if somebody was really dead or not, or how long they were dead. And, you know, cultures have a different definition of death and different technologies and everything else. So yeah, some of it's to be taken with a grain of salt. But at the same time, for the most part, people are going to know if somebody else is dead or almost dead.
Exactly. And for the audience, I should bring it out. I just got my Elvis book, and it's same publisher as you, Gregory. And needless to say, not surprising, I do quote Moody in the book, because people had a lot of Elvis near-death experiences, and he breaks them all down. They travel to the afterlife, to some place, and there's Elvis, and Elvis is usually like, oh, you got to go back, honey, you know, or something like that. Or in the moment of their death, they look up and they go, Elvis, and then they pass away. So Elvis has been busy as busy as Osiris, it seems, in our modern times, Gregory.
Yeah, that's a great example, actually. And you know, it raises the question of, is this being of light that everyone's seeing in an NDE, do some people really see Elvis and really see Jesus and really see Muhammad or the Buddha or whatever? Or is it a matter of this is the same being and everyone's projecting their own identity, symbolic identity onto it because it's, you know, culturally familiar or somebody that they relate to.
Yeah. We do that in dreams. We see a figure and we think it's that figure, but it's actually some issue or symbol that we're not. Right. We clothe it in what works for us. It's human nature. Yeah. I like, there's one part where you talk about one of the reasons people get sent back, and we can all relate to this, and that's dealing with the government and bureaucracies, is that there could be a clerical error. So heaven's databases aren't perfect, right, Gregory?
Yeah. And that's another really good example of a cross-cultural difference, because we're used to the kind of NDE where somebody is sent back because, you know, the being of light tells them you need to go back and care for your child. Your people need you, your parents need you. Or sometimes, like, you have to finish writing your novel or whatever it is, fulfilling your promise on Earth. But in other cultures, it's often, like in India, for example, in some small-scale societies, it's a case of mistaken identity. So it's a bureaucratic error on behalf of the afterlife bureaucracy. And so they'll say, you know, we got the wrong Gregory Shushan. We need to get the one that lives in this village in Iraq or whatever. And then that poor Gregory Shushan's going to die permanently, and I'll come back to my body and report my NDE. So we've got the similarity of, you know, being told to return and returning, but the reason for it seems to be cultural. So, and those are the kind of things that I just find really intriguing. Like, why is that the case? And rather than just kind of pretend it's not the case or gloss over it, which is what near-death studies has mostly done, I'm just kind of not really wanting to go there. I think it's more important to look at them head on and trying to figure out what's going on.
Indeed, yes. So for those of you who may be Christian or Muslim, if you find yourself in hell, send an email, because it could be a mistake. So, but I'm joking. And yes, in your book, you break down the 9 core features. I actually did a graphic. If I could just pull it up for you here. And yes, there is a clerical mistake. It's the body was from coding. But here you have 9 core features. And let me read them, if you don't mind. One is that out-of-body experiences and ascend. Two, corpse encounters. Very important, where we see our bodies. Three, traveling through darkness. Four, deceased relatives and ancestors. Five, beings of light. Six, evaluation of earthly life. Seven, barriers and obstacles. Eight, divinization and transcendence. Nine, other realms and a return to the true state of being. So that's it. Or do you want to comment on these? Are these pretty much the commonalities?
Yeah, those are the kind of thematic commonalities between the afterlife beliefs in all five, six of those ancient civilizations. And they just so happen to be extremely typical features of a near-death experience. So to me, I should also make clear that for the most part, there aren't NDEs from a lot of these civilizations, or there's kind of hints of them here and there. But most of the actual religious texts, I was looking at descriptions of the afterlife world or myths about journeys to the other world. And these are the kind of similarities that I found, the most kind of highly recurring ones. There are others here and there, but as far as ones that apply across the board, these seem to be the main key features.
Yeah.
And again, in very culturally symbolic expressions. So the being of light is the sun god Re in Egypt, or the sun god Utu in Sumeria, in Sumer. And evaluation of earthly life. We have this typical stereotype of a panoramic life review where everything happens at once and you experience the emotions of everybody that you've interacted with, everyone you've hurt. But in other cultures, it's really just more of like a kind of general evaluation of your life. It's not this kind of panoramic thing. There's one Native American example where the person having the NDE sees a photograph of himself on the wall, and that in the afterlife, and that photograph kind of like embodies all of his existence in his past life. But they don't really explain how that happens.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I think the exception you write that would be the Chinese. The Chinese wrote a lot of NDEs and just put them as history, right?
Yeah. They're a lot of the Chinese examples going back to like 8th century BCE, they have a tradition of actually documented historical NDEs. At least that's the way they're presenting them. And they're going to be signed off by like so-and-so, the governor of so-and-so province, this is hereby submitted to the emperor on this day. and a lot of the reason for that is because the NDEs feature some kind of revelation or precognitive idea about a prediction about some political event that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Whether those are probably tacked on at a certain point to kind of justify what the political maneuver was going to be happening. But it seems like NDEs were used in this kind of official capacity in ancient China.
Yeah. Well, let's get to some of the theories. Of course, you address many of the hypotheses about why we have this collective near-death experiences. I think one of them is the shamanic source hypotheses that some scholars have suggested, that afterlife beliefs stem from shamanic vision experiences. Of course, that's what the shaman did. They call it the world's oldest religion. The shaman was, part of his job was taking these tours into the spirit world and interacting with the dead and gods and all that. So what are some problems, or why is it compelling?
Good question. I see it as kind of a chicken or egg kind of example, because near-death experiences happen spontaneously. They don't happen within like a culturally generated practice like shamanism. It's not people sitting around deliberately wanting to have an NDE. So it's shocking, for one thing. It's disruptive to the person and to the community even, because they think somebody is dead and then that person comes back to life. So I speculate that shamanism kind of stemmed from reports and observations of NDEs, and that it kind of evolved as a way of replicating NDEs, and specifically in order to gain the benefits of it. Because when people have NDEs, they come back transformed in a positive way. They often claim to have a certain kind of knowledge or a certain kind of skill, often like supernaturally related. They can suddenly heal people, or they're telepathic or precognitive or whatever. So the shamanic type experiences were deliberate journeys to the other world, brought about by, you know, repetitive drumming and dancing until you collapse, or cutting off your circulation until you collapse, or drugs or whatever. But with the express intention of, you know, traveling to the realm of the dead and getting information, or bringing about some transformation. So, because of the fact that, that NDEs are natural and spontaneous, I kind of think they must have preceded shamanism, and that shamanism must have arose from the idea of, you know, wow, this can happen. How can we get there without actually dying?
Right. No, that makes sense. And another one, and this one sounds, very sexy, is quantum mysticism. Some writers, such as theoretical physicist Amit Goswami, have established quantum physics alongside the notion of a collective unconscious to try to explain the nature of survival after death. So what do you think of this? Yeah, we got to bring quantum physics into everything these days, right?
Yeah. This is... I included that just to kind of be thorough and address one of the explanations that, as you said, everyone's going to come up with it. I'm probably one of the least qualified people in the world to evaluate anything to do with quantum physics. So I kind of relied on some of the critiques that made sense to me. And that was basically that these kind of ideas about quantum physics and the soul, they seem to be overlaying the behavior of particles onto the human soul, with ideas of non-locality and things like that, and the ability to even exist in soul form and have a consciousness that is, you know, sustained after death. And just from what from my understanding of it, there's not really any scientific basis for saying, you know, the soul, which we haven't even identified or understand anyway, behaves like quantum particles.
Right.
So, I mean, people can speculate about it all they want. It doesn't mean they're wrong, but just as far as an evidence standpoint, it doesn't seem to have gotten very far so far.
Yeah. And it mentioned, the collective unconscious. So that brings us to somebody we've done so many shows on this individual, and that's Carl Jung. And of course, you deal a lot with Carl Jung in your book. We both know that, yes, he had his own NDE. I don't know. He was getting it was a dentist appointment. He had a heart attack, and then he had this great NDE. I remember him saying, you know, I realize this earth sucks. I can't wait to what I experienced was so, you know, the numinous he talked about. But Jung talked about the collective unconscious. What do you think of that idea? I know sometimes it's a cop out, right? We'll just put it in the collective unconscious. Why there's so many similarities.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's exactly it. And I think the main thing is that, it took me a while to figure out what my issue with it was that it's not descriptive of any, it's only descriptive. It's not explanatory of anything. Mm-hmm. All it does is say, oh, it's the collective unconscious, which just describes something that we share that's amorphous, that hasn't been, again, demonstrated or proven, or we don't even really have a theory about how it works. So where do these ideas and symbols that different cultures are drawing upon, where do they originate? Like, somewhere out in the stratosphere, or through like some kind of psychic link that we all share. I mean, it's all pretty nebulous. So to me, the idea that NDEs could stem from a collective unconscious is practically the same thing as saying they're all in the brain, that it's just the dying brain, because all it is actually that is even probably more explanatory, because at least it points to one particular occurrence that's bringing them about that we all share. But as far as the collective unconscious goes, it's like, I don't know, we share this thing without any explanation of what it is. And even with the dying brain hypothesis, actually, that doesn't explain specifically why one culture would have a panoramic life review and somebody else would see a photo on the wall representing their previous life, and why somebody would be a, you know, mistaken identity returned from their NDE. And so, yeah, the more I've learned about NDEs over the past 25 years or so, the more questions I have about them.
Yeah, that's usually it is. You go down the rabbit hole and it's, oh my God, I got so many more rabbit holes to go down to.
Yeah, exactly.
And what's interesting too is, as you write, is that of all things, you think Jung's Voyage of the Afterlife would be a nice cafe by the lake or something with people playing violins, or, but his was very Hindu, wasn't it? It was,
yeah,
wrapped in a Hindu culture.
Yeah, and he's literally in space, and he sees a temple carved out of a meteor with a yogi in there surrounded by flame, and he sees the earth below. I mean, it's pretty amazing. But, you know, if somebody who is just so totally immersed in the world's religions and mythologies and symbols, that in a way it's kind of not surprising that he would have this, you know, mind-blowing mega NDE. But it's interesting because he also reported the NDE of one of his patients, a woman whose name, I don't think he gives her name actually. But what I found interesting about that is there he doesn't talk about his own NDE. And when he does write about his own NDE later, he doesn't talk about this woman's NDE. So he didn't put them together and theorize them, or, you know, he could have been the Moody. He could have said, here's an experience, yeah, that I've identified. And, but for some reason, he either didn't make the connection or just didn't do it in his writing.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, well, as Jung got older, he got into that, I don't care, I'm famous, I've done, yeah, so much, I'm just going to do what I want to do. So,
yeah,
it depended. Yeah, and again, this is also like the dream state, where if you read something or watch a movie or something's on your mind, that will appear in your dream. So, yeah, we clothe these things, not even just in our culture, but what's really at the forefront of our ego sometimes, so...
Yeah, and another good example of that is sleep paralysis, which David Hufford wrote this great book in the 80s, The Terror That Comes in the Night. And he actually coined this phrase, the experiential source hypothesis, which I use a lot. And it's basically that our beliefs in the supernatural or the afterlife or whatever religious or spiritual beliefs we have originate in experiences. So, and he found that with sleep paralysis, that cross-culturally, people have this experience of when they're on the border between sleep and awake, between the dreaming state and the awakening state, which is called the hypnagogic state. That can happen either when you're falling asleep or when you're waking up. There's this phenomenon that happens to people, and I'm sure a lot of your viewers and listeners have had it, where you feel like you're being held down by some presence. There's like a weight on your chest. You're being suffocated. There's like this sense of a malevolent presence in the room. You can't scream, you can't move, and it's just this kind of overwhelming sense of fear. And there's no doubt in your mind that you're awake, because it's happening in the place that you're actually sleeping. So it's not a dream where, you know, it's taking place in some other place. So he found that being that's holding you down is identified differently in different cultures. And so it's an old hag in Newfoundland, and it's a hungry ghost in China or whatever. So he was able to establish, you know, in a really quite scientific way, that the experiential source hypothesis does happen with sleep paralysis. And sleep paralysis has been demonstrated to be a neurophysiological thing. It's not a supernatural occurrence. So if it can happen with that, which really is... It's a non-controversial statement, really. It's a scientific statement. So if it can happen with that, why not with near-death experience or out-of-body experience or any number of other kinds of supposedly supernatural events?
No, it makes perfect sense. Graham, let us bring you in. Any questions or comments from yourself?
I was going to sit here and say I very much appreciate his very objective approach to it, where it's objective definitions for what constitutes the NDE, you know, to strip away all the cultural stuff. I was curious on one is, what's his thought? I've been working around with the idea that baptism was a drowning-induced NDE, a controlled that sort of a way, where they prep themselves for the mental state to, you know, start a new life, induce the NDE, and that was basically what John was doing back in the day. I don't know if that's consistent or if his work contradicts that. What do you think?
Now, even before that, Zoroaster did the Tushna Mate, where he just threw himself in a lake, went down, and suddenly the gods were talking. And I always wonder, were you just holding your breath, Zoroaster? Were you, getting close to the threshold?
Or possibly on drugs at the same time.
Oh, of course. Yeah, Zoroaster. you have to include drugs.
That's an interesting idea about baptism. I guess it's possible. I don't know if there's anything that would be able to, prove that, any evidence for it. But I have always wondered, like, why NDEs aren't more central or aren't central at all to Christianity, because, the entire religion is founded on the death and return of Jesus. And there's very little in the New Testament about his journey to the underworld. It's called the harrowing of hell in biblical studies. And there's very little about it. And it's described in an apocryphal text called the Gospel of Nicodemus, which was somewhere along the line. I don't know if it was Council of Nicaea or whatever. But the church decided this text is not going to be canonical. It's not going to be part of the Bible. So they deleted it. But my question about that is always why, because that text really does seem like an NDE. It explains what happens from the time he died on the cross to the time he came to life and walked out of the cave. And it's a, underworld journey. He frees the souls of the sinners in the other world and comes back to life. So I think it's probably a case of the whole teachings of Christianity is that you cannot be saved and you cannot go to heaven without going through Jesus first. Mm-hmm. Whereas a near-death experience basically proves that everybody has direct access to the divine. There is no going through Jesus. You have an NDE and you're there, and it doesn't matter if it's Jesus or a nameless being of light or Elvis or whoever. And I think that was maybe seen as a threat to Christian doctrine. And so maybe they deleted that Gospel of Nicodemus. And so maybe, it's conceivable, to Graham's point, that there could have been either a baptism or some kind of Christian mystery cult type thing, which is replicating Jesus's NDE, which was common in Greece and Rome. And maybe that all just got kind of deleted from Christianity. The only exception is Mormons. Mormons, they value near-death experiences because it's in their better interest to show that, like, divine revelations are still going on, because their founders were only from the 19th century. So they wanted to stress that this isn't just some biblical thing that happened in the old times. We're still having them.
Another possibility is that the NDEs got written out, it seems, roughly about the same time as reincarnation did, for a lot of the same reasons. It allows the individual direct access and removes the authority of the church and the hierarchy.
There's an interesting parallel with India, actually, because most of the evidence for NDEs from India are in the text I was looking at, the earliest text, which goes from the Rig Veda, which is minimum 1500 BCE, but quite possibly a lot earlier, and then going up through the Upanishads, which I think the latest is 200 or something like that BCE. So the earliest were like in the, there's like a stream of afterlife journey texts, which are kind of myths involving characters and gods. So I don't consider those so much specifically NDEs, but in texts like the Atharva Veda, which I think is about 1200 BCE, there's like medical descriptions of calling back a soul from the other world And there's descriptions of what an NDE is like. There's not actually an account, but they obviously are showing awareness of it. But as time goes on, as the doctrine of reincarnation enters into Indian tradition and Vedic religion becomes more like Hinduism proper, then the NDEs start trying to kind of disappearing at that point. And the stress becomes a lot more on reincarnation and overcoming the cycles of rebirth, essentially. So I don't think it's not that they weren't happening anymore, but it's that the religious system no longer offered a venue for them to be expressed.
Makes sense. Yeah. But the idea, it makes sense what you guys are talking about in the Gospel of John. What is the death sentence of Jesus is not thinking he was the Messiah or this and that. It was the raising of Lazarus. That's what made the Sanhedrin said, this guy's got to go. Because again, the idea of an NDE and all that and Jesus controlling it was just too much. So perhaps it was a warning. But to Gregory, in this show, obviously, we do a lot about Gnosticism. And Gnosticism, as scholarship has shown, is an Egyptian religion. In other words, their texts have this, again, this grand adventure that you go through. And of course, there's snakes and archons and beings of light and lessons and all that. But the Gnostics are pretty clear that, yes, these texts are for when you die, but you can also do them while you're alive. In fact, you should. It's almost like practicing for the marathon, you know, go to this astral flight and do that. Now, the difference is, there's nothing about destroying the body. It was always, you know, purify, be healthy. And then you get this extra body, the Okema of the Neoplatonists. So you're not going, but you have this astral body that will go. So what I'm saying is that, A, I think obviously that's why the one reason the Gnostics had to go. But the idea of going into the underworld as a practice probably did happen, right? I mean, you have the Gnostics, the mystery religions. Didn't you have to go down into Hades and meet these terrible death gods and then come out? So it seems that some civilizations were practicing the NDEs on purpose.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that ties in to the, you know, shamanic replication hypothesis, which is, yeah, I mean, they knew about these experiences and they wanted to try to find ways to experience it themselves. The ghost dance is another great example because like everybody's heard about the ghost dance, but almost nobody knows that it was actually founded on the near-death experiences of the prophets that first initiated them. And it was just, you know, expressly to like basically say, if you institute this dance and start doing these practices of drumming and chanting and whatever, you can have one of these experiences too. So, and I think it's probably the same with Gnosticism, with ancient Greece and Rome. Ancient Greece and Rome, it was, you know, again, you, like you said, you descend into this underground sanctuary. You're probably also drugged or at least disoriented in some way. Sure. And you have it in your mind that you're going to have an experience of the other world. So you're led down into darkness. And then there's descriptions in the text about mystery cults that there's like an epiphany of a deity. And I think what that probably is like suddenly light is shown on a shining god in the other world. And then once you emerge from this experience, you're transformed. And that's what basically qualifies you to have a positive afterlife when you really do die. It's that knowledge of what it's going to be like. And that ties into, you know, Mahayana Buddhism and the idea of like dying consciously and being prepared and forewarned about what you're going to see, which is, you know, the whole point of Books of the Dead, including in Egypt, is to teach you about what the experience is going to be like so you can be prepared and die consciously, essentially.
Exactly. And even when I was a Roman Catholic, if I had a good priest at Mass, it was just a given. You know, you go to Mass and he talks about, and Jesus died and all that. You were supposed to go on this adventure with Jesus, like relive his death and resurrection. So even Mass is sort of a mini mystery religion if you do it right.
Wow. Yeah. That's interesting.
It's all there. So we want to just to cover, we probably don't have time to get into all these wonderful cultures, but we probably should mention more about the Egyptians, because nobody did death better than Egypt. I can think of Carly Simon and the James Bond song. Nobody doth death like the Egyptians, but they really they were really into it. But it's fascinating because they had two fears of the afterlife. Was one is avoid annihilation, but the other one is it's interesting. It's not I'm just going to turn into the soup of Ra or Atum and become, but still save some of your individuality, right? I mean, you still could be, you could be somebody in the afterlife, you know?
Yeah, for sure. The greatest fear was annihilation, just not existing. But the tricky thing about the Egyptian afterlife is even after all these centuries of Egyptology and the study of these texts, there's a few things that still aren't really clear. So for example, the soul joins the sun god on the circuit into the sky, into the solar realm, where they experience all these, you know, idealized visions of Earth. So like these beautiful marshes and hunting grounds and mm-hmm. birds and fields and everything. And then they descend into the other underworld where it's below the Earth. They call it the sky below the Earth. And that's where there's different threats and terrors and, you know, the snake that spits fire and the baboons that might cut off your head and all these kinds of things. And you're traveling with Ray. And then at some point you become Osiris in the other world. And then you circle back the next day and you do it all over again. So it's presented as this like cyclical journey. But then on the other hand, there's also texts that very clearly describe certain realms of the heavenly realm as being permanent, like you're going to have an eternal life in the field of rushes or the marsh of offerings or whatever, the offerings being the offerings that people on earth are burning and sending to you in the other world. So so yeah, we're not really sure if this is like this only happens to certain people, that there's different afterlife fates for some, because then also others are told you know, you can have a pretty good afterlife being a servant to Osiris, but you're not going to become him and you're not going to join the sun god. So there's obviously differences in the fates that people have, but this distinction of the eternal cosmic circuit and the eternal dwelling in one space is kind of confusing. But yeah, otherwise it's, there is this tension, I think cross-culturally actually, that of becoming one and becoming unified with the divine, but at the same time, retaining like this capacity for conscious thought and still being an individual.
Yeah, there's still Miguel or Gregory or Graham there. We're not part of this cosmic soup.
Yeah. I mean, the only one I can think of that's an example of that would be the, you know, Buddhist idea of nirvana, where it's this kind of, you're no longer a conscious self. You've kind of really been subsumed into the supreme oneness.
Because the conscious self was never a real thing to begin with. So
exactly.
Why hold on to something that was never real?
Yeah.
But our egos disagree. Our egos don't want to let go.
Yeah.
It's
how much is that the idea of becoming a god in all these different religions, how much of that is just human ego that, you know, in such a fundamental part of the Indian and especially Hindu texts is, you know, that the Atman is like the inner unchanging self, that thing that we consider to be us from the time of our earliest memory until we die, basically. That's one and the same as Brahman, which is the universal consciousness of everything and the cosmic sound of Om and all that. So the realization that Atman and Brahman are one and the same is like the thing that will lead you to overcome the cycles of rebirth. Which is great and it's wonderful and it makes sense in a lot of ways. But part of me also thinks, is that just the human ego wanting to be God?
Right.
I just can't accept that, you know, we're only Atman, we're not also Brahman.
Yeah, for sure. And I wanted to mention Mesopotamia because, again, it's a fascinating view of the afterlife. Most people know Inanna's descent into the underworld, Gilgamesh, you know, the demons, the Gala, but could you explain what their overall view of the afterlife might be?
Yeah, that's an interesting discovery I made with this. There's been this kind of received wisdom in Assyriology, you know, the study of Mesopotamia. And specifically, the idea is that the Sumerian afterlife was just like this shadowy, vague kind of half existence in this realm where not much of anything happens, and it's kind of slightly miserable, but it's not being punished, and it's just like this half-life kind of situation. And that's been kind of repeated throughout, you know, the couple centuries that, this kind of study's been going on. But as I was looking at the texts afresh, and I kind of looked, I didn't look at summaries, by the way, of any of these texts. I went back to the actual original text in translation. I can't read all seven languages. But looking at them afresh and from outside the field and with a kind of contrary skeptical mind anyway, I was thinking, what do these texts actually say? And I found lots and lots of examples in the Sumerian texts of light in the other world, beings of light, feasting, parties, meeting your deceased relatives, definite indications of judgment, lots of judges. And of course, you know, there's not going to be judgment in an afterlife if there's not a diversity of fates, including rewarding and punishing kinds of fates. So that didn't really make any impact in Assyriology, but I, you know, I was convinced of this discovery. So and I thought that was really interesting, just that it challenges received wisdom of decades. But the other interesting thing about Sumer was everyone knows the Epic of Gilgamesh, which you mentioned. His Sumerian name was actually Bilgamesh, and there's a chapter that didn't make the final cut, and that's called The Death of Bilgamesh. In which he actually has an NDE. It's possibly the world's earliest example of a near-death experience that happened to somebody who was a historical figure, because people think that, historians think that he was an actual Sumerian king. But it describes his, you know, lying on his deathbed, his soul travels to the other world and meets these deities who are radiating light, and they review his life, and he meets his relatives and all the rest of it. So that's one of the contenders, I think, for the world's earliest NDE. And it's presented very differently from, as you mentioned, the Descent of Inanna, which is, you know, she's a goddess and she travels there to overthrow the queen of the underworld. And it's got all these like plot elements, whereas the Death of Bilgamesh is just, it's basically an NDE episode. And when he comes back to his body, he then prepares his own funeral, knowing what's going to happen to him in the next world and that he's about to die. So.
Yeah, fascinating. And to make matters even complicated, another wrench in these issues, especially trying to understand the ancients, is that we've been taught that if there's a soul, there's one soul, or we have one consciousness or divine spark, as the Gnostics talk about. But as you point out in your book, and many know, in Egypt, we had different souls with different functions and destinies. And you point out in Mesoamerica, it was the same thing. The soul had different components, and one could go to the underworld, one to the Zabalba or something, you know?
Yeah.
So that pretty much, that complicates thing is like, oh my God, I'm Legion, and parts of me go to different places or
stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And in China too, the soul components. It's usually the case though, that, you know, when you start parsing them, one of them is like the life energy. Mm-hmm. One of them is in Egypt, it's the name. It's a particular, you know, type of your identity. But the thing that's consciousness always seems to be a unique, specific thing. And I think it's that we would most likely kind of interpret as the soul. Yeah. And yeah, it does make me wonder too, that going back to the Egyptian thing, is it possibly the case that it's not this dichotomy of do we do this or do we do that? Maybe it's that in this afterlife state we're omniscient and omnipresent, and we're doing everything at once. So that could be an interpretation as well. Yeah, and it could help resolve a lot of the apparent contradictions in these texts, which I don't think are contradictions. I think they're just things that we don't understand.
Right, right. Their consciousness was completely alien to us, and yeah, how they perceive time and space. We're doing our best with how we've been conditioned.
Yeah, and that's something that's, I've seen countless scholars, even today, saying things like you know, these pyramid texts are so contradictory. These scribes must have had no idea what they were talking about. It's like, no, I think it's that you have no idea what they were talking about.
Exactly. So, no, yeah, we have to. It's a different type of consciousness and a different world. And, well, as we get to the end, Graham, do you have any last question or comment for Dr. Gregory Shushan?
My last question would be, where do shared death experiences fit into there? I had one of those as a kid when my great-grandmother died, and I was just curious how that fit into a schema.
Yeah, that's really interesting because those also occur cross-culturally. There's a great example from ancient China of a man who was on his deathbed and he has an NDE, and he goes to the other world and he visits the emperor of heaven. This is, I think, 800 something BCE. And then standing there next to the emperor of heaven, there's a child. And then some really unusual things happen in this NDE, such as a bear comes and attacks the emperor. And then there's some prophecies made about what's going to happen on, you know, on Earth with these political events, et cetera. But so fast forward later, the man comes back to his body. Years pass and he's walking down the street and there's a man standing in his way in this town and the guy won't get out of his way. And he's looking at him and thinking like, this guy looks kind of familiar, but I don't know who he is. And so this man starts saying to him, you died on such and such a date and you were standing, you were visiting the emperor of heaven. You saved him from a bear attack. There are these prophecies, blah, blah, blah. And the guy who had the NDE says, how could you possibly know this? And he says, I was the little child standing at the side of the emperor, now grown up. So, it's an interesting phenomenon. And then there's also the examples of people who will see the soul of somebody who recently died in the other world, and then they come back to their body and they're told, Uncle Bill just died. But Uncle Bill doesn't come back. So this idea of meeting people who recently did, who didn't know had died, I think is a pretty amazing phenomenon. And again, that's another one that happens cross-culturally. To me, that's actually more compelling evidentially than some of the more scientific consciousness studies things about NDEs. I don't have any way of explaining that.
Thank you.
Sure.
And how is that the research, all this research done, modern and ancient NDE, how has it changed your worldview or affected you?
That's hard to say because I've never been a religious person. I wasn't like raised in any particular religion. I was raised with, my mom was kind of like a hippie type, you know, there's this phrase of George Harrison Hindu, and that's kind of what she was like. So I was kind of raised with these kinds of ideas and consciousness, and she was a scholar too. So she had, you know, books by Aldous Huxley and Jung and all the rest. So I didn't have like any crisis of faith or anything like that, but I also didn't necessarily have any kind of like enlightening moment. But I think what's happened is just over the years, almost like by osmosis, I've kind of lost any kind of fear of death that I might have had, any kind of residual fear of death, because I just don't think it's going to be terrifying. I don't think it's going to be any kind of hellish kind of experience. And the types of things that people are taught about the afterlife, for the most part in religions, just don't seem to be borne out by the people who actually seem to go and spend some time there.
So. The other world. Well, like you write in the book, another theory flipping the script is that the NDE and afterlife is all a tool of control, social control. It's possible that people edited and made these up just to make sure, take our fear of death and control society and say, oh, you know, heaven is just like our government down here. So, you know.
Yeah. I don't think the experiences were made up, but I think they were then manipulated and controlled by the powers in you know, who are controlling the religion and politics. And in fact, there's good evidence for that, because in Egypt and China and India and other places, the afterlife goes from being like a kind of heavenly realm where everybody goes without really overt punishments. There's threats of annihilation and all that, but it's not like if you're bad, you're going to go to hell and suffer. And if you're good, you'll go to heaven. Those kinds of threats and promises really kind of came about more in later periods as religion became more democratized and these texts became available to more people, as literacy increased, basically. So I think, maybe initially NDEs had a stronger influence on religions as they were being developed, but then later they kind of became used as a tool of manipulation and elaborated upon in these mythical stories.
Yeah, for sure. Same as it ever was with any sort of revelation. You know, look what they did with Jesus, right?
Right. Yeah.
Control. So awesome. Well, we are at the end. Again, I highly recommend you get the book. So many great details. The case studies are just endless, and they're wonderful, and they're rewarding. And again, Gregory gives you a view of the afterlife, not just the experiences, but what these cultures, how they approach death, the afterlife, their God. So I certainly highly recommend Near-Death Experience and Ancient Civilization. I have it on the show notes, Gregory, but where do you want to send people? Your website?
Sure. You can go to gregoryshushan.com. The book should be available pretty much everywhere that sells books. And I'm also on Patreon. It's Patreon.com/GregoryShushan and pretty much all the social media accounts.
Oh, very cool. On Patreon, what do you offer if people want to sign up?
Free books and allegedly a historical near-death experience of the month, but I've been pretty busy lately, but I plan on picking that up pretty soon.
All right. Yeah. People will be interested in that. Awesome. Well, we're at the end. Good quotes and comments in the chat. Good to see everybody there. But Graham, thank you for keeping us company on this journey.
Always a pleasure. I need to get Gregory's book so I can get in some practice on this dying thing.
You'll enjoy it. You will enjoy it because I know you do like the ancient history. Well, Gregory, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for
your time. And thanks for creating this wonderful book.
Great. Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure is all ours. And for everybody else, good shows coming next week on Robert Anton Wilson, Mars, and of course, some more Gnostic stuff. So, thanks for your support. Please share, subscribe, support in any way you can. I do take crypto donations, one-time donations, and I do have a Patreon too. So join. You can join for as little as $1 a month for those of you who I know might be challenged economically. But yeah, let's support all of us who are trying to pull over the veils to a richer history and culture and mythologies across the globe. Take care, everybody, and we will talk soon. Hey, shining crazy diamonds, please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.